Today is March 1st, 2017, and we're in Walker Hall in room 106. My name is Susan Atkinson, and I'm an intern in the Spring 2017 Samuel Proctor Oral History Program for the African American and Latinx Histories Internship. Okay, so thank you for sitting down and talking with us. May you please state your name for the record?
My name is Dr. Vincent Adejumo.
Okay, and can you tell me a little bit about your family and your parents' names?
All right, my family, my mom, she is from Fort Pierce, Florida, which is a couple of, about an hour or two away from Miami. And my father is from Lagos, Nigeria, which is obviously in Africa. And so, and, you know, just a little background as far as my family name. My father, obviously, his last name is Adejumo. And it is part of the Yoruba tribe in Africa, in Lagos, Nigeria, specifically originating in Ile Ife. And so that's where the origin of my last name comes from. My mom, she's from, like I said before, from Fort Pierce, Florida. Originally, her family, one side is from Lake City, the other side is from Georgia, Donaldsonville, Georgia. And I was born, my mom and my dad met in Tampa, and I was born in Tampa, Florida. Okay. And that's where I was born and raised.
Awesome. And can you tell me what their names are?
Okay, so my mom's name is Linda Adejumo, Jenkins Adejumo, and my father's name is Michael Adejumo.
Do you have any siblings?
Yes, I have one sister. Her name is Michelle Adejumo. She is currently a engineer in Atlanta, Georgia. Wow. She got her master's degree here from the University of Florida.
That's really impressive. And
she did her undergrad at Florida State University.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask you more about that later on. Okay. So, you were saying that your father is from Nigeria. Is there like a strong cultural heritage that he brought to your family? Or how was it like growing up in Tampa?
Well, growing up, first of all, my mom and dad, they divorced when I was 6 years old.
Okay.
So, so I lived primarily with my mother, but my father, you know, was a big part of my life, an important part. He remarried when I was 10 years old. And so my stepmother also played an important part of my life. So all three of my parents were equally important. And the tradition and culture that my dad brought to the family, to, you know, myself and my sister, what he instilled in us, was the tradition of education. Nigerians, when they immigrate over to the United States, they are the highest educated immigrant class in the country. So he brought that mentality over with him. He got his master. When he first moved to the United States, he attended University of Georgia, not University of Georgia, Georgia State University, and he got his master's from Georgia Tech University. So he got a master's degree in planning from Georgia Tech Institute. And, you know, that mentality, that of tradition of education that's valued in Nigeria and his family, his father, my grandfather, his father was actually a lawyer. And was one of the first people to graduate from the University of Lagos with a law degree. And his mother, my grandmother, was a school teacher. Wow. So that tradition of education, he immigrated over to the United States for school. You know, he brought that mentality when we were born and instilled that in us, even though we didn't primarily live with him, but every time we saw him, each week we saw him, we stayed the weekends over there, you know, all the spring breaks and summers, like we always spent with our father. So we very much took on the tradition, education tradition of our father. And my mom is educated as well. She went to, you know, University of South Florida. for her bachelor's degree. So my mom instilled education in us as well. Mm-hmm. So
that's really interesting. Can you tell me, say your stepmother's name and your grandparents that you talked about?
My stepmother's name is also Linda Adejumo.
Okay.
My grandparents, I've only known my grandmothers here in the United States. My stepmother's mom, Evelyn Daniels.
Okay.
And my mom's mom, Vera Jenkins.
Okay.
So I've only known them. I never knew my grandmother in Nigeria.
Okay.
So, or any of my grandfathers, they all passed away.
Okay. We're going to move on from here. I just am interested. How did your father decide to move to the United States?
Honestly, he tells a story. You know, he moved to the United States in the 70s. And, you know, at that time, you know, United States film industry was really start to become international. And, you know, so he said he saw America in a lot of the movies that mm-hmm. were that migrated over to Nigeria from America. And so he thought that it would be a great place to come over and to live the American dream, so they say.
Okay.
But obviously when he first came here, you know, he didn't, you know, racism isn't a thing in Nigeria. It's all about tribalism and classism in Nigeria. But coming over here and experiencing racism, you know, that was something very new for him, and something he had to adjust to. So mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Would he talk to you about that, or like with your mom, and like, I don't know?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, you know, he always made sure that we understood that we are Black,
mm-hmm.
and that we have to work twice as hard to get to the places that we want to get to, whereas others might not have to work so hard because by virtue of their skin color. So that's why he made sure that, and my mother as well, they both were in agreement and on the same page, and my stepmother, that education is what is going to take you far in life in this society, in American society. And the more education that you have, the better off that you can realize that great old American dream that we all strive for. And so that's what pushed me to, you know, pursue the PhD and complete it. That's what pushed my sister to complete her master's degree in engineering from University mm-hmm. of Florida as well. I got my PhD from University of Florida. And, you know, and it's something that will always be with me.
Okay. That's awesome. So can you just list off the schools that you attended in Tampa, like elementary, middle, and high?
Okay, so elementary school, I first attended a private institution. It was called Maranatha. So I attended that institution up until the second grade, and then my mom and dad divorced. So then starting in third grade, I attended public school. So from third through fifth grade, I attended a school called Edison Elementary. And it's in a, you know, it's in a neighborhood in which I grew up in, a predominantly Black, low income neighborhood. middle school, I attended a school called, Young Middle Magnet School. It was a magnet school because most schools in magnet and, high schools in the predominantly low income neighborhoods are magnet because they're trying to attract, students from the suburbs and higher class students from the suburbs. So Young Middle Magnet, it was a magnet school. And then high school, my first two years of high school, I actually attended a school that was outside of my neighborhood zone. It was called Lato High School. The reason why is because the neighborhood school that was present in the neighborhood from the 1930s to the 1970s, called Middletown High School, when desegregation happened, it was a segregated school, for Black people. Only Black people could go to that school, and it was a predominantly Black neighborhood, which is the neighborhood I grew up in. So once desegregation came in the 70s, they desegregated the school, and they actually made the school a middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And all the kids that was in the neighborhood, they bused them to different high schools throughout Tampa and Hillsborough County. So I was slated to go to Lato High School. So I actually was one of the last people or the last people in the neighborhood to be affected by this. So then my junior year, they built a school called Middleton High School. So the middle school that was Middleton High School, they renamed that. And then they built a new high school and they renamed, and then they named that Middleton High School. And it was a couple of miles from the original Middleton High School,
which is now a middle school.
Yeah. So the original Middleton middle school is now a middle school.
Right.
And so they reopened up, they built a new high school and named that Middleton High School.
Got it.
And so I was the first graduating class of that high school.
Oh, interesting.
So that school opened up in 2002. I was a junior at the time. I graduated from that school in 2004. Hmm. And I had very strong, you know, because at Lato, you know, the student population there, you know, it was different from, you know, what I was used to as far as growing up. And the teachers wasn't really as invested in the students. But when I got to Middleton, the teachers were very invested in the students. It was more African-American and Black teachers at that school. The principal was Black, African-American, the assistant principals, all of everybody in administration was Black. At least, but again, Middleton High School, when it reopened as a high school, it was a magnet school as well. Mm-hmm. So there was this interesting dynamic between the regular part, which I attended, and then the magnet part, you know. So the regular part, as we would say, you know, it was known for being, having more of the people from the neighborhood, the hood, as they would say. You know, it was a weird atmosphere because we had like two valedictorians, two salutatorians, you know, one for each side.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. And so there was this interesting, you know, I wouldn't say it was tension, but it was just people knew the difference. Like if you were in the magna part, then it was understood that you were probably white. Or if you were Black in the magna part, you were probably from a suburb. You know, you wasn't from the hood.
You were a minority.
Yeah. 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 So I was in the regular part. You know, for whatever reason, I never was tested for gifted or any other of these accelerated mm-hmm. programs.
Here, I'm going to pause it. Okay, we're back. We had a knock on the door, but here we go.
So it was an interesting dynamic between the magna part and the so-called regular part, mm-hmm. If you were in the neighborhood, you were assigned to go to Middleton High School. It was interesting, you know, being at Middleton High School, again, it was a magnet school as well. I took a lot of courses that were a part of the magnet program while at Middleton, mm-hmm. but, you know, I wasn't officially a magnet student. And I never was tested throughout my high school, middle school, or elementary. I never was pegged as a gifted student or anything like mm-hmm. that. And so it's interesting, you know, now being in this space and having a PhD, you know, people ask me all the time, like, why weren't you part of gifted program or this or that? And it's like, I honestly don't know.
Right.
Maybe it was by virtue of me being a Black male and they assumed that I, you know, being from the neighborhood, they assumed that I didn't have that capability. I'm not sure. So it created an interesting dynamic in a sense also because at Middleton High School, being that, you know, these neighborhood for so long from 1970 up until 2002, the neighborhood kids were divided.
Mm-hmm.
And so because there wasn't a centralized high school for them to go to. So it created this interesting thing in which, you know, when the 1980s came with the crack cocaine era, you know, people form into their own cliques according to their block or where they stay, right? And because there isn't, you know, because the school was taken out, the high school was taken out of the neighborhood, it created this disunity, so to speak, this division
mm-hmm.
among cliques, among gangs, so to speak. So that was a huge thing. So when Middleton came back in 2002, you know, the thing was that there was a lot of fights,
right?
A lot of fights between the neighborhood people. Because for so long they were so divided.
And you're saying, just so I understand, like, there was division within the neighborhood because of the different schools that people
attended. Yes.
And then once you guys all went to Middleton, it was like
tense because you gotta understand for years, you know, especially in Tampa and the South and Florida period. Mm-hmm. Things such as football, that's like a big thing,
right?
You know, and so going to the football games and, you know, that dynamic of people fighting at the football games, like that happened every football game at Mills High School. There was a fight with not only, you know, it was with students who went to Middleton or it was elements in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, and so for the first, I mean, we were, I think my first year we were a D school, second year D school. And then I think after I left, they were an F school, a couple of years. I think maybe 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, they were a B school, but the average grade that the school has had since it's open has been either a C or a D.
Right.
And, you know, and that's just by process of the neighborhood. I mean, you can't change the environment of the neighborhood. For so long, it has been a forgotten part of Tampa almost.
Right.
You know, and then, you know, Middleton kind of brought it back. But, you know, the spotlight a little bit. When I went home the other day or a couple of months ago, I saw that they built a new Walmart. You know, I guess that helps with jobs or whatnot. Mm. But, you know, it's still a situation in which it's a space in which there's not a lot of opportunity. People can't see past the neighborhood, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it's an issue. I think about it often. I'm just glad. People tell me all the time, I'm one of the few that made it out. You know, my sister made it. She went to Middleton as well. And, so after Middleton, both of us, I went to Florida State and she followed in my footsteps.
What's the name of the neighborhood that you grew up in?
It's called, it's east side of Tampa.
Okay.
And you know, it's several many parts of it, but the part I would say that I grew up, was called Jackson Heights.
Okay.
Yeah. I've heard Jackson Heights.
Can you tell me a little bit about, the, like, studying culture and then the social culture of your schools?
Okay.
And how did it affect you that you moved to so many different schools?
Well, I mean, technically I didn't move to, I mean, because elementary school, you know, I'm from kindergarten through mm-hmm. second grade, we went to private school.
Right.
And then after that, I was pretty stable in the public school system.
Okay, except for in high school.
Except for high school, I just went to two different schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I had to.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was zoned to go to those different schools. But middle school, the same school. Elementary, third through fifth grade, the same school.
Mm-hmm.
And really, as far as the culture of studying, I did most of my studying, not really at the school, but in the background of going to school, we went to the Boys and Girls Club.
Okay.
So that's where I also developed a lot of my study habits and a lot of my social interaction skills.
Oh, I thought I was going to sneeze. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's fine. So that's where I developed a lot of my study habits and a lot of my social interactions was at the Boys and Girls Club.
Okay.
Played sports there, played basketball, baseball, football. we went there every day after school and we went there in the summers as well.
Okay.
And so that was the outlet, I would say, because my mom, she worked. So, you know, she couldn't keep up with us 24/7, obviously. Right. My dad, he came in, you know, whenever it was needed. But, you know, as far as having that 24-hour care, it was home, then it was school, then it was the Boys and Girls Club. And back home again. That was the pattern.
Okay.
So
that's awesome that they provided like that structure.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so what about high school participation and like organizations and all that?
Oh yeah. In high school, I was very active. At high school, I played basketball.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at Lato High School, I played basketball and football. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to Middleton, I just played basketball. Because, you know, starting in my junior year, started thinking about college and that type of thing. And I started working. So I didn't really have time to play both football and basketball. So I just played basketball. I worked at the not Publix, but it's called Sweet Bay now. But before that, it was called it's called something else.
A supermarket?
It was a supermarket, but I can't believe I'm forgetting what it's called. It'll come back to me.
Yeah, just blurt it out.
yeah. It's Sweet Bay now. Actually, I think it's not Sweet Bay anymore. It's Winn-Dixie, because Winn-Dixie bought up all of the Sweet Bay. So I worked. I first started working at Subway. And the Subway I was working at, one night I was working late and we were robbed. And like a guy pointed a gun at me, like flashed a gun. And so I stopped working there. I'm just glad I escaped with my life.
How old were you?
I was 16 at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So I worked at Subway. I worked at this place called Malibu Grand Prix. And then I worked at the supermarket. So... So that's what I did in addition to playing sports. And in addition to, I was in a couple of clubs. The main club I remember being in was called FBLA, Future Business Leaders of America. And that was great. Like, that's where I, you know, got the idea that I wanted to major in business when I got to college, because it was a huge impact, that club. I was in a few service clubs as well, but that's the one I remember the most vividly is FBLA.
Making an impact. And briefly before we move on, you're saying that like the faculty at Middleton was mostly Black and compared to Lato High School. How did you think that affected the high school, or did you like that, or what's your commentary on that?
I loved it. I mean, I felt... You know, and some of these teachers that was at Middleton actually attended Middleton when it was segregated. Mm-hmm. So, and actually the principal of the school was a star football player at the school, when it was a segregated school. Wow. So having that history and that passion, you know, every time they talked to us, you know, it was teaching, but it was more like almost like a soul winning type thing every time they talked to us, because they understood what we were going to be faced with when we got into the real world. I mean, did it work for everybody? No. But for those of us who did listen, we turned out pretty well. I mean, some of my classmates went on to be MDs and, you know, lawyers, and, you know, have gone on to do great things, went to the best of institutions, Harvard, Brown, Yale, Florida State. but I could definitely tell a difference in my attention span and wanting to learn. Because, I mean, when you learn from someone who looks like you and genuinely has your best interests at heart, it makes all the difference. You know, and that's why I don't subscribe to the idea that that a child, especially a Black child, necessarily has to be integrated with white students in order to learn. No, that's not true, because I've been that Black child and I've achieved the most when I was at my learning stage at the K-12 level, when it was somebody who looked like me, who taught me. And it was just that understanding that if I didn't do what I was supposed to do, then it was a quick phone call to my mom or my dad. And, you know, the situations was taken care of. Okay. My stepmom actually went to Middleton High School when it was segregated as well. So that was additional. And she's from the neighborhood. So that was additional, motivation, especially when I became a junior, additional motivation to excel in my academics, because I knew what was at stake. And the staff, faculty at Middleton, you know, instilled that, make sure we understood that.
Right. Have you heard about Lincoln High here in Gainesville?
Yes, I know all about Lincoln High.
This is like kind of reminding me of that a little bit, of the situation of like the culture and resisting kind of integration and all that.
Right.
Okay, so you went to FSU.
Yes.
I went there for undergrad for 2 years.
Okay, okay.
So go Noles.
Go Noles.
Can you tell me about some of your experiences there? I know what activities were you involved in?
Okay, yeah. When I got to Florida State initially, I was a bit reticent as far as participation. I mean, I was 17. I graduated high school when I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Florida State at 17. And, you know, lanky guy, very goofy, you know, obviously smart, but, you know, still green to a lot of things.
What dorm did you stay at?
I stayed in Kellum.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I was in Wildwood right next door.
Yeah. And actually, before what made me want to go to Florida State, because originally I was a Gator fan.
Right.
Because I liked Emmitt Smith and I liked some of the other football players back in the day in the 90s. And then I decided to go to Florida State because my junior year, going into my senior year of high school, there was this program called Boy State. In which, there was a program that I was involved with called Computer Mentors.
Okay.
That taught me how to, repair computers and to build computers. That's what I like to do in my hobby now.
Wow.
I like to repair and build. I like to build computers. I love it. I get a high from it. But,
impressive.
Yeah. So they put me onto this program called Boy State. And so I applied for the program. I got in. And so basically the program sends males up to Tallahassee
mm-hmm.
for a week. And you learn about how government works. You learn about how state and local government works. And so I was there and they had us stay in Kellum Hall for a week.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it was Kellum at the time, but looking back, it was Kellum Hall.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so that was my first introduction to Florida State and the idea of wanting to go to Florida State. And so when it was time for me to apply for schools, Florida State was the only school I applied for.
Wow.
Florida State was the only school. And I barely got in because, you know, they had this thing where if you don't make the scores necessarily that they're looking for, you could come in for the summer, prove yourself, and then continue on in the fall. So that's what I did.
Okay.
So that's how I got to Florida State. And when I was at the Boy State, one organization that I saw was Phi Beta Sigma.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the bowling alley and they was having like a little thing, a little shindig at the bowling alley. And that's when I first saw Phi Beta Sigma. So when I went back up to school the next year, because I went to Florida State 2004. So that Boy State thing was 2003. So Florida State, I enrolled in 2004, summer. When I first went there, Phi Beta Sigma wasn't on campus. They were suspended from campus.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a chance to look at all the other organizations. I wasn't even really focused on fraternities at the time. Like, I just was a bushy-eyed 17-year-old, like, just trying to soak in everything,
mm-hmm.
you know, the whole atmosphere of Tallahassee. And, you know, so my freshman year, I wasn't really involved in anything. I mean, I just was trying to make sure that I kept my grades up. I stayed in Kellum Hall. Actually, no, my freshman year, the summer I stayed in Dorman Hall. And then the fall, I stayed in Kellum. I actually didn't even have housing. And for 2 weeks, I had to stay in the entry. And then they put me upstairs in like the conference room of Kellum Hall. I had to stay there for like 2 weeks.
Were you the only person, or was
it was several other people?
Oh,
but we was waiting on housing.
Right.
Yeah, so we stayed there.
That's unreal.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, but I was like, oh well.
Yeah.
But it was hard, you know, when I think about it, because trying to focus on schoolwork and
mm-hmm.
having to be on, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially if it's like the beginning of the semester.
Yeah, and as a freshman, you know.
Right.
So so I did that. And, you know, first year, I wasn't involved much. But in second year, I remember I came back home going into my sophomore year that summer. I took a couple classes. And I met up with a buddy of mine. He played basketball for University of Tampa. Mm-hmm. He introduced me to his friend who was part of Phi Beta Sigma. So, you know, and I was like, okay. So he said, you ever heard of Blue and White Weekend? I was like, no. So he took us to Gainesville in 2005 mm-hmm. for Blue and White Weekend, a thing they used to have in the summer.
What's every that?
Summer.
Can Blue, you explain for
it's
me?
It's the Phi Beta Sigma fraternity. They have mm-hmm. A annual weekend or week of activities.
Okay.
And so in those days, it was a really big thing, like a huge thing. And it was so huge that it was like a national part. It was part of the national identity of the fraternity. And so they used to have like a big, like three big parties at the fairgrounds,
mm-hmm.
Friday and Saturday. They used to have like concerts, and it was a huge thing. So he took us there, and I was like, wow, like the Sigmas are,
this you know, they cool.
loud. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I went back to Florida State that fall of 2005, and the brothers of Phi Beta Sigma at Florida State, they were back on from suspension. And so they saw I kept coming to their events, and then eventually they approached me,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I end up committing to them, so to speak, and I was initiated. So that was the organization I did, Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated, Upsilon Chapter, Florida State. That was spring 2006. Other organizations I did. Once I joined Phi Beta Sigma, other things, activities I did, I was a resident assistant.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I was a resident assistant for 2 years.
Okay.
In Kellum, first year in Dorman.
Uh-huh.
As a RA, and then the second year back in Kellum, my junior year. I know, right?
Kellum is just, I think they're tearing it down now, I think.
It's already torn down.
Okay, yeah,
it's
already torn down.
Yeah, and so I did that, and then I was part of the Black Student Union, I was mm-hmm. part of the NAACP, and it was there at Florida State, but especially through Sigma, because when I first was initiated in Phi Beta Sigma, they elected me as president.
Right.
And that's unheard of, you know what I'm saying, to be a new initiate and to be president at the same time. That never, almost never happens. And so I was elected as president, and that is where I really learned the value in programming and organizing right. and social justice.
What did that entail?
As far as being a president?
Yeah. Well, actually, hold on. Can we get back to that question?
Yeah.
So you said, okay, you committed fall 2005.
I told them, I said, okay, I want to go ahead and be initiated.
And
then the process started spring 2006.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that takes a while.
Yeah.
Okay, so I actually have a few questions about this.
Yeah.
So you were president. I understand that it's part of the Divine Nine.
Yes.
Can you explain to us what that is, please?
Okay, so the Divine Nine is nine national Panhellenic organizations. The nine national Panhellenic organizations are predominantly Black, Greek-lettered organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And they were started because Black people weren't allowed to pledge white fraternities, for lack of a better, you know.
Right.
They wasn't allowed in IFC or Panhellenic. So that's why we started National Panhellenic. And so the first fraternity, there were several fraternities that started up, kind of died out. But the oldest surviving fraternity is Alpha Phi Alpha. Then Alpha Phi Alpha, the sorority was created, Alpha Kappa Alpha. Then after Alpha Kappa Alpha was Kappa Alpha Psi, then Omega Psi Phi, then our fraternity, Kappa Alpha Psi, and then it was Kappa Alpha Psi, then Omega Psi Phi, then it was Delta Sigma Theta, then it was our fraternity, Phi Beta Sigma fraternity, then it was Zeta Phi Beta sorority, then it was Sigma Gamma Rho sorority, and then Iota Phi Theta. So that's the Divine Nine.
Okay.
And so they call it Divine Nine because those are the prominent and main Black fraternity and sororities. And so
nationally.
And so you know, with the white, predominantly white fraternities and sororities, they have different councils. There's IFC, Interfraternal Council, which is predominantly white fraternities. The Pan-Hellenic, which is the predominantly white sororities. And then it's us, we're combined. Mm-hmm. And that's always has been historically the case. I mean, if you think about how the state of Florida situated, Florida State, which was a white woman's college, University of Florida, which was a white male's college, and then Florida A&M University, which was the Negro college. Mm-hmm. So it's always been that combining.
Right.
Because throughout history, America has viewed black men and black women as the same, as genderless. There's mm-hmm. no distinction. That's how larger dominant hegemon society has viewed the black bodies. And so it's, and so I explained that that's why we are in a combined council. There's no separation.
Yeah, I was, when you were talking about that, like the IFC and the Pan-Hellenic, I realized, like, why are the white women and the white men are separated, but then you guys have the, like, the Divine Nine and you're all together. So that's interesting. I appreciate your input on that.
Yeah.
And what does the Incorporated mean? Is it was a fraternity for men. That's it.
Right. Right. It's incorporated, which means that, so there's a difference between being a corporation and then being incorporated, you mm-hmm. know? And so that just means that you're an official organization.
Okay.
Being that you're incorporated.
Awesome.
So, I mean, most fraternities and sororities are, mm-hmm. but we just emphasize that because mm-hmm. it's, like, we're official, you know
identity,
what I'm saying?
Right.
It's part of the officializing us. Like, don't skip over us because we are an incorporated organization.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, we were about to start talking about, like, the role that you played as president and how that shaped you and experience in that.
When I was president, having to deal with a lot of situations, that were happening on campus, not just specifically with us, but, you know, just being a part of the African-American community
mm-hmm.
and being that I was president of my organization, being the first in line, the first point of contact whenever there's an issue. That was an experience. That was an experience. And at the same time, I was a resident assistant, too. So, you know, it was, and then trying to keep up with studies and, you know, the affairs of the fraternity. I mean, so you gotta understand, we had just came back from suspension. And so I inherited like a lot of different things that were not necessarily handled before the suspension. So having to deal with that, having to educate myself on what actually happened and went on and how to go about fixing it. I had a lot of strong mentorship, and the main thing was, you know, how to get funds back into the chapter,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we had different initiatives. I mean, obviously you have your socials and your parties, but also, I mean, one thing we used to do was we used to work the football games,
mm-hmm.
And that was tough because you work the football games on Saturday, that's 8 hours, 10 hours at the football game at the stadium because you got to prepare the food and then...
This is for funds.
Yes, for funds because you get money. Okay. I don't know if they still do it now, but they would pay like $900 to the chapter or whatever organization that worked the football games. And, so having to get up early in the morning, mm-hmm. prepare the food, then be there at a 4-hour football game and then it takes 3 hours to clean up everything. So that was a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a lot.
And organizing all that.
Yeah. So we did that. And I think that year there was like 8 football games.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're black students. Like we don't have money. You know what I'm saying? So a lot of us worked other jobs, but we still came together to do this because we understood what the implications for. So we other fundraising activities did. We also did car washes. We stepped for money and we won some shows and mm-hmm. we got money for that. So and we also had additional intake initiatives. So when you take in new members, that's kind of a moneymaker too, because you know,
you have to pay dues.
Yeah, paying dues and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So we did a lot to get the chapter back to where it needed to be, you know, to be viable and for the future. Right. So being the president and having that experience, learning how to run an operation like that was, you know, and I was only 19 years old.
After having it been in shambles.
Yeah.
May I ask, why were you all suspended?
The chapter was suspended. Why was they suspended? They were suspended. There were some issues going on with respect to, the intake process.
Okay.
And so I think they didn't follow the rules of intake. And so they were suspended because of that. Yeah.
Do you think, how do I word it? Like, does that happen? Would you say that happens more or less? Or like, what do you think compared to like the IFC fraternities? Do you guys?
Definitely think Black fraternities get it the worst. And I definitely think there's an incongruence as far as the punishment for Black fraternities because compared to the IFC fraternities, because the IFC fraternities, they give, you know, it's a kind of an industrial complex, so mm-hmm. to speak. Like, they donate a lot of money to mm-hmm. the school, and they have powerful alumni
right.
who give money. You know, a famous person who pledged Phi Beta Sigma here from University of Florida is Emmett Smith.
Wow.
Yeah, he pledged Phi Beta Sigma.
Wow.
Or he was initiated into the chapter here, Zeta Kappa chapter here at University of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But I think overall, though, as far as we can't compare to IRC. We don't have houses like we don't have. I mean, if the university, because you gotta understand, University of Florida and Florida State both were, you know, created at their current locations in 1905, 1906, when the state of Florida reorganized the whole system of education, higher education. So with that, when they did that, you know, much of the land was allocated, and the fraternities and the sororities had their land already set in place when these schools first opened.
In 1905.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So I tell students this all the time that, you know, and with these schools, with the state of Florida organizing, and I don't know if this part of the Samuel Proctor Earle Oral History Collection, but I'm going to say it so because this needs to be on record.
Yes.
But the state of Florida mm-hmm. actually designated the University of Florida, you know, because the University of Florida was like four separate campuses,
mm-hmm.
right? Before 1905, it was four separate campuses. Then, so University of Florida applied, or the state of Florida applied for the University of Florida to get the land grant, right? And so they got the land grant, but the stipulation of the land grant was that this university has to take in Negro students. That was the stipulation. Obviously, they wasn't going to go for that. The state of Florida, you know, this is 1903. They wasn't going to go for that. So that's why they designated FAMU also as a land grant institution. However, FAMU did not receive the funding as a land grant institution until 1966. So what the state of Florida was doing was they was diverting those funds from FAMU and giving it to the University of Florida. That's how, in part, the University of Florida has become Gator Nation, because of those diversions from funds.
Wow.
You know, it's not, you know, people say, oh, it's because of the, you know, the best research. Okay, how do you think the research happened? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you think the capital and the money mm-hmm. was put up for the research?
Mm-hmm.
It was because the state legislature was diverting the funds that was meant for Florida A&M, the Negro school, and was diverting it to the University of Florida.
And how did Florida A&M stay afloat until the 60s?
Private funding. Private funding. That was the case with most of our Black institutions.
Right.
And private funding, and just, you know, working with, you know, they maybe received a little bit of funding from the state, but they wasn't getting that funding from the federal government that they were supposed to get.
Right.
So that might be something you want to further look into. And so when we look at the, you know, what went on with that, and just the, you know, the funding situation, and, you know, with our fraternities and sororities, you know, not having the ability to get acquired the land as the IFC in these in Pan-Hellenic, that created that creates the conditions for the NPHC to not be on the same prominent level as the white fraternities and sororities.
Right, that's really fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. So what was your like overall experience in as like president and like in your fraternity?
It was awesome.
What did you take away from it?
It was some highs, it was some lows. We had some very low lows. but the overall experience I took away from it was hard work.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work hard, and feeling like being marginalized, you're already marginalized as an African American at a predominantly white institution. So having the brotherhood and being able to function within the brotherhood, to this day, honestly, I could count on my hands the number of white students that I still communicate with today that went to Florida State with me. It's maybe only one or two.
Mm-hmm.
Because with the, you know, function with the brotherhood, and at that time Florida State had a very strong black population, and then FAMU right across.
Yeah.
You know, it was so easy to just create my own world, mm-hmm. so to speak, my own worldview. And I went to Florida State, I was in the school, I triple majored. I did business management, management information systems, and human resource management. So I was oftentimes the only black person in my class, but I learned to just kind of, you know, okay, this is my class life. After class is over, I'm back to what I'm comfortable
right.
with, you know. And so, you know, some people say, oh, well, is that a bad? No, it's not. I don't feel it was a bad thing at all. You know, it wasn't a bad thing at all because, you know, because if we do the reverse, okay, how many people who were white were willing to go out of their way and interact with the black students on campus?
Right.
Not a lot, you know? So I didn't feel it was any detriment. Mm-hmm. I turned out fine. Most of my classmates who graduated with me from Florida State who were black and African American gone on to do great things.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a detriment at all, you know? So my experience was great. I wouldn't have changed it for anything in the world. I had a lot of good experience, a lot of bad experiences, but the bad experiences ended up being for the better. So
awesome. That's really great. So after that, how was the, you went to Washington for Strayer,
mm-hmm.
Strayer University.
Mm-hmm.
How was that
switch
over, and what did you study?
Well, first of all, it was a journey to even get to that point.
Okay.
Because once I graduated from Florida State, it was a higher recession. It's 2008. I couldn't find a job.
Okay.
And so what ended up happening was I moved back home. And for about a couple of months, I was on my auntie couch and I was doing odds and end jobs. I was cleaning under boats. I was digging ditches. I was directing traffic at fairgrounds. I was driving cars at auctions, and I just graduated with 3 degrees: business management, management information systems, and human resource management. But I couldn't find a job. No one could at that time, you know, especially, you know, people of color, you know, because the unemployment rate for people in color, if you go back to 2008, was, you know, it's always been twice that of whites, but it was even more dire then. And I couldn't find a job. So I did those little odds and ends jobs. Finally, it was so bad that, you know, we would get, because me and a buddy of mine, we would wake up, and it's the same buddy that went to University of Tampa. We actually played basketball together at
mm-hmm.
Middleton High School. That's how we became friends. So we actually used to wake up 2 a.m. in the morning to go to temporary job agencies and get, you know, these odds and ends jobs to make money. So we would be out from 3 a.m. all the way. We wouldn't finish until 8 p.m.
Oh,
and we would all come home with like $30, $40 for the day because we had to pay taxes. We had to pay the transportation fee and all this type of stuff they take out of paycheck. And it's only a single paycheck for the day. you know. And so it was crazy. Like, and we would every night we would go and go to CC's Pizza Buffet. It was on. It was like $3.99, and so we would do that. And so we did that for a couple of months. And finally, I got my. I started working at Citigroup, the bank, but that only lasted 3 weeks. I got fired because they was downsizing, and you know they said I wasn't doing a good job, but it was really because they just wanted to get rid of people. But that same day I got fired, I got hired at Middleton High School.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I got a job working at Middleton, working in the guidance department. Because I used to always carry my resume, have on the suit, because I was still, you know, looking for a job. And so they hired me minimum wage. I think minimum wage at that time was like $7 an hour. And so I worked there for a couple of months. In the guidance department, helping students get to school, helping, you know, recommendations, just being a presence at the school. And I got my first big break and I started working at Strayer. So Strayer, you know, I was hired on as a, they was training me to become a manager of a campus. So they moved me first originally to Atlanta, mm-hmm. right? So I was in Atlanta for a okay. couple of months. And then I got a phone call. So when I was in Atlanta, I was working in the admissions office. I was an admissions officer for mm-hmm. Strayer University. Then I got a phone call and they said they was moving me to Augusta, Georgia to work under the best admissions person to work under in the university. So I got transferred to Augusta, Georgia. It was so boring. Yeah, it was the most boring place on earth, I would say. Only thing there was the golf course where they do, you know, where Tiger Woods won all his awards. So I was there, and it was there when I started, when I rolled into their Master's in Public Administration program. And so I did that program online. So in Augusta, it was something, it was some improper things going on at that campus at Augusta. And I called the national recruiter. I said, look, if you guys don't move me from here, mm-hmm. I'm going to go to the press with what's going on out here. Because at that time, what was going on at for-profit colleges, which is what Strayer is, it was receiving big national news. And so 3 days later, I get a phone call. They said it was moving me to D.C. So that's how I got to D.C. Okay. And in D.C., I was working in the student support office and financial aid office. So I worked there for about 10 months. And then from there, they moved me to Philly. So I was in Philly for about 11 months and I was admissions manager at Philly.
Oh, okay.
And so I finished up my master's degree while I was in Philly. And, you know, I just didn't like the atmosphere at the university anymore because they, I in my view, they were targeting like a lot of minority students because of, you know, they knew if they enrolled minority students, they'd get a lot of Pell Grant. So they was targeting them and having them enrolled into the school and like, you know, and a lot of students end up having to take out a lot of loans to pay the high tuition costs. And a lot of these people, they have no really financial literacy. And so they would default on a student loan. And once you default, that's it. You know what I'm saying? It's hard for you to... Nowadays, they check your credit score to even get a good job, mm-hmm. you know? And so, and obviously, if you want to buy a house or a car, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just got tired of it. And I took the... to get into their master's program, you didn't necessarily have to take the GRE if you had a good score, if you had a good GPA. So I studied for GRE so I could get into PhD program because I wanted to take a look at this problem in more depth.
Yeah.
So I took the GRE. I got into both Florida State and UF. My sister was here at UF at the time, starting a PhD in engineering, but she just ended up getting a master's. And I decided to come to UF with my sister. And so that's how I got from DC to University of Florida.
What improper things were they doing in Atlanta?
No, it was in Augusta.
Oh, in Augusta, sorry. That's right.
The missions off the head director of the campus,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're promising students that, you know, if they come to this school, then, you know, they'll be able to sit for certain exams. And it's like, no, because the school isn't certified. You know, you have to go to the state certify certain school mm-hmm. in order to do that, in order to sit for certain exams. So some would be like, oh yeah, you'll be able to take the nursing. It's like, no. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Or he would promise them that he would give them additional like book vouchers, like additional funds from the university to purchase more books in order to get them to enroll. And that was improper.
Yeah.
You know, that was against, that was illegal. So it was other stuff going on like that. It was things like that.
Yeah.
Because the goal is at those type of schools is to get as many enrolled and on the front end as possible, because you have goals that you have to meet.
Right.
That you had to meet. Now, things probably changed since then, but this was the atmosphere back then.
It's like a business.
It is a business. It is. I was on the business side of the school. That was the business side of it. So you have the business side and you have the academics. And it was constant friction between the business side and the academic side.
That's so, it's so like shattering when, cause when, you know, when I was applying to colleges, I'm like, they care about my essay and, you know, they really want me to see if I'm an academic achiever. But then the more I've been in college and learning about the politics of everything, it's like very business oriented, which is kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, so at UF, you got in, what's the deal?
I got in and the first place I went to, when I first came to UF, when I first visited UF, first place I went was the Office of Graduate Minorities Program.
Okay.
So I went there. Then, because I got in for political science, right?
Mm-hmm.
Second place I went was I visited Dr. Sharon Austin, who's now the director over the African American Studies Program, but at the time she wasn't. I visited her. She introduced, she's a tenured professor in political science. She introduced me to people who eventually were on my committee for my PhD program, for my PhD degree. So I am in third place I went to was the Institute of Black Culture. Fourth place I went to was here, African American Studies Program. So I established that base of, you know, people that I could rely on if, you know, if things didn't go as swimmingly as I thought it would go. And that was so key. It was so clutch, because when I first came, I didn't have funding. And I actually, you know, the graduate coordinator at the time, you know, because I said, okay, I'm accepted. You know, how will I be able to pay for this? And the graduate coordinator, I would say he lied to me, this person, because he said that, and I think he, in part because I am a student that is Black, I still feel that way to this day. They could deny it, but I feel this way to this day that, you know, this person said that, oh, well, we don't do, we don't fund first year students from the department. You have to come in and prove yourself and you won't get funded until maybe the second year, but probably the third or fourth year. So you're going to have to apply for loans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I was dejected, like, you know what I'm saying? Especially because I'm coming in with a master's degree, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm coming in with the ability to teach because I have a master's degree in public administration in the field. I mean, this is political science, my PhD, but I'm coming in for policy and administration. So I'm thinking maybe I can get maybe a TA-ship or something like that.
Not to mention you have months and months and months, years of work experience.
It's work experience.
You know what I mean? Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So this person, it almost made me not even want to, you know, just go back to go working. But I went to the OGMP office. And they ended up, you know, the first 2 weeks in the fall, because I actually came in the summer of 2011 through a program called the Board of Education program. It's like a summer bridge program. So they give you a stipend and they give you a place to stay on campus. And you take like three different like courses, not intensive courses, but just to get acclimated to the school.
Right.
So that was perfect. That program, I think they should have that program for every minority, you know, who comes to this school, or anybody who applies that should be, you know, that was great. And so establishing that relationship with the OGMP office, they said, okay, well, you could work in our office, you know, and we'll fund you if you work for us. So I said, okay. So I worked for them for 2 weeks, and then Dr. Austin came and said, hey, do you want to be my research assistant? And I was like, of course. So I ended up being her research assistant, you know, and so I didn't have to work in the OGMP office anymore. And so, but had it not been for me you know, I established that rapport with Dr. Austin, you know, before I even was a student here. Mm-hmm. I mean, she wrote me a recommendation letter, you know, not even really knowing who I was, you know, but because I was a African-American black student and had a, you know, and my resume looked good, I presented myself, she believed in me. And this is why we say it's so important to have black faculty. You know, this is, that's the number one, if that, for no other reason, to give a person, you know, a chance who otherwise not might not have a chance. Mm-hmm. You know, even though I had all these credentials, there still was this gaze upon me that I wasn't, you know, a student that wasn't typical of the UF brand, right, for graduate school. Right. You know, and I think in part because of my race and my gender. And so, you know, being a black male and all the stereotypes that comes with that. And so when she stepped in and said, hey, you could be my research assistant, that's invaluable. You know what I'm saying? That is invaluable because now I have an opportunity, and I don't have to worry about taking out loans. I don't have to worry about where's my funding going to come from. I don't have to worry about going to work necessarily. I could just, you know, she just gave me some tasks to help her with her book. And that's all she wrote. Yeah. And so that was my first year. My second year, I got involved on campus. That's when I started really getting involved, my second year. Mm-hmm. I was president of the Black Graduate Student Organization, mm-hmm, my second year. And in fact, if I show you this photo, and that was 2012, 2013, I was president of the Black Graduate Student Organization. Mm-hmm. And much like what I learned in college, with being president of Phi Beta Sigma, I implemented some of the same programs. Like one of the things I implemented for the Black Graduate Student Organization here that we did when I was president of Phi Beta Sigma was support black business. So every month we would go to a black business establishment and patron it. So, mm-hmm, we would go oftentimes to where this is where I learned about Lincoln. We would go to Ruby's on Fifth, mm-hmm, and the owner there went to Lincoln. And that's where we, you know, it was like, wow, like this is what I'm used to. This is what I'm, mm-hmm, I'm used to. You know, we go eat oxtails and rice and, you know, it was great. And so having BGSO here, you know, and going through my studies here at UF, like, really, really helped me. Really, really having an African-American studies program really, really helped me. And then so when that blackface incident happened in 2012, which ended up being in the movie Dear White People, mm-hmm, we were the students on campus who were part of the Black Graduate Student Organization. We were the ones who helped push that initiative for us to get the major. Because we had been on this campus since 1969, the African-American Studies Program. And students at that time still couldn't major in African-American studies. You know, so that's a problem. Like, What the heck? Like, you know what I'm saying? So it was really interesting. I'm going to actually show you a picture when we got the major.
Okay, I'm going to take a picture of your picture.
Okay, I'll actually send it to you.
Oh, okay, great. That would be awesome.
Let me see.
So it seems like your dad was right all along, or like it seems like there's a constant theme of you having to like work double as hard and double take as hard. What you earn.
Exactly. You know what versus I mean? If I was in a different color, it would be no issue.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So that's the interesting about it is that, you know, with all these credentials, you know. And then when I, being here, BGSO, and going through the program, and I ended up getting another master's in political science, mm-hmm, and my PhD in political science. And then, you know, now I'm teaching an African-American studies program. But all that would not have happened had Dr. Austin not been here.
Reach out to you.
You know, and, you know, by virtue of me being me, mm-hmm, you know. So I'm showing you this. Here's the picture. Where is it? Here's it. I actually did this flyer. This is when we first got the major. And here's
is that
the,
you?
Yeah. I was president of Black Graduate Student Organization. This is Andre. He was a really prominent student back then. This is 20, 13, like January. That's Justin.
I know Justin, yeah, of course. Yeah.
These two students were the first, some of our first majors in the program. Jamal, he's a teacher now. LaToya, she's a PhD student in political science. And Jamal, he was the first president. I mean, he was the second Black president of student government.
Wow.
Yeah, Jamal. So he was on staff here at that time. Yeah.
So it all links. You guys have like a strong foundation.
Yeah. So Jaron, he was in PhD program. He finished in ag leadership. And Justin is getting ready to finish now.
It's PhD, yeah.
Yeah.
How is the Office of Graduate Minorities and like, you know, the
Black Graduate Student Organization?
But I'm trying to think how, like, your foundation here, how would it compare to, like, the FSU culture? Because you said, like, with FAMU and, like, your fraternity, you were, like, in another world. But here, like, how are your sentiments about that?
I mean, it's being here, you really can't avoid not being, you know, a part of, I mean, because it's also the setup of Gainesville, too. It's not really a lot for young professional African-Americans to do here. You know what I'm saying? It's majority, you know, whatever there is to do is always students involved. And we don't want to, you know, necessarily be around students all the time, you know, because we teach here. We work here. So it's really hard to avoid that. And Tallahassee is different because there is a prominent Black population there. You can, you know, you could go to the side of FAMU tracks and not have to worry about seeing your students because they're not going to go over that side. You know what I'm saying? You know, but here you're kind of, it's the swamp. You're mixed in and you can't avoid, you know. But for me, establishing that base, you know, it simulated a little bit of what I had in Tallahassee. It wasn't the exact same, but, you know, it really helped me. It helped my mental, you know. Especially with dealing with some of the things, as any student goes through when they're going through a PhD.
Right. It's so difficult.
It's very difficult.
Can I ask what you wrote your dissertation on?
I wrote my dissertation on for-profit colleges and universities. And how...
Exactly. So you're passionate about it, huh?
So, and because I felt like that was a topic I could wake up with every day and not get sick of, you know, because of my experiences. And it was how the government or how for-profits lobby government institutions and how government institutions respond to for-profit colleges and universities. Right. So especially with the whole gainful employment and student loan default rates and that type of thing was going on at that time.
Because at the Strayer, it sounds like they were kind of just bringing people in and then not supporting them.
Yeah, they didn't really. They didn't provide a strong support system. Yeah. No.
Okay, so you mentioned can you talk more about the blackface incident and the establishment of the African American Study Program and why in the world it wasn't why did it take that to establish it?
Well, it was several blackface incidences that happened. Actually, there was one in 2011. Mm-hmm. Actually, there were several instances that led up to that. First of all, you go back to 2010. There was an African student here in 2010 that was shot in the face by the police. And then 2011, there was a blackface incident. 2012, there was the other blackface incident that made it to Dear White People. And then also, like, the fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha and Kappa Alpha Psi, they both got suspended at that time, while other white fraternities did worse things and were not reprimanded as much as those fraternities were. So there was, like, just this atmosphere, much of what we feel now of, like, all of this stuff happening and there's nothing being done. Administration is tone deaf, et cetera, et cetera. So we got together, a group of students, Dr. Austin was putting in years prior to this, was submitting proposals for there to be a major administration in Northern. Deans or previous directors of the program, Stephanie Evans, Faye Harrison, They submitted proposals for there to be a major. They all were rejected for various reasons. And it's always been a need for it to be here. But it took that blackface incident for it to happen because of the national press. I mean, it was covered by everywhere. It was covered on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. And so the university doesn't like negative press. And now with, I think, too, with social media being such a big thing now, like they couldn't ignore that those type of incidents. And they knew they had to do something. So we think that them giving us this major at that time was part of the, okay, we're going to do something. You know, obviously, it's not going to prevent racist things from happening on campus because obviously it's still happening like now. But it was just kind of like, okay, we'll finally give you this major. And so initially, we only had 3 people majoring in it that started that summer. I had started teaching the Intro to African American Studies course online. I was the person to develop the first course in AFA for it to be an online class here at the University of Florida. And so from there, it just took off. Now we have over 100 majors. We have almost 500 people taking our courses. When we first started, we had maybe 170 people. Now we have almost 500. And it's just continue to grow.
What was your feeling when you finally, this was accomplished?
It was, it's hard to describe, but it was overjoyed, man. Because again, being that we've been on this campus since 1969, the university says it cares so much about diversity. It cares about this. It cares about that. But when it comes to actually taking concrete steps, at that time, it just was like, okay, you keep saying this, but our enrollment is declining, which it still is. Mm. We can't even major, and this is supposed to be the flagship university. Like, that's unacceptable, you know? Right. And so those points were made, and that was the result.
It took national news.
It took national news.
Interesting. All right. All right, moving on. April 2016, the WUFT website published an article named UF Students Faculty Commemorate 45th Anniversary of Black Thursday, which reports on a speech that you gave on the anniversary of Black Thursday. So can you quickly recap what happened on that important day? And what is your opinion and, like, the biggest impact and meaning that day had?
On Black Thursday?
Correct.
UF students withdrew from the university. This was in 72. There was much like racist incidents that's happening now, it was happening then. To the point where the president at the time was arresting students. And so it took students not only here, but Florida A&M students came down and protested and joined the protests and, you know, helped with, you know, the students to withdraw from the school, you know, because that was the leverage. And so the aftermath of that was when they established the Institute of Black Culture, you know, for there to be a separate space for students. So what I was telling the students last year when we had that was that, you know, there's still so much to advocate for on behalf of especially African-American population here on campus. I mean, because, you know, it took an African-American, Virgil Hawkins, mm-hmm. if you know who Virgil Hawkins is. It took him and his efforts to, you know, not only for African-Americans to be here, but all people of color. You know, there were no Latinos here before him. There were no Asians here before mm-hmm. him, you know. So it took him and his efforts and his sacrifice in order for there to be people of color on this campus. With that said, with Black Thursday and with some of these other things that were going on, I was just telling the students last year that they should, continue to advocate and take direct action, you know, ahead of, because you shouldn't wait for stuff to happen on campus in order, you know, you should be, you know, doing the business of, you know, for example, meeting with deans and meeting with administration to constantly get your voice heard, you know, on what's going on, not just waiting around for something to happen.
Right.
Because when you wait around, you know, it could be 30 years from now. it could be 40 years from now before anything concrete is done for what needs to be done to make sure that there's an environment for all students, for all of our students to feel welcome and safe.
Right. I'm going to quote something that that article said too, that the, apparently you said, which I think, okay. You reported to have said that UF needs to aggressively recruit more diverse faculty and student body. Yeah. You still agree with that? Oh, you were saying this before.
Yes. I've been saying this since I first got on this campus.
Why is that so important?
It's so important because it helps with the atmosphere on campus. Like when I was at Florida State, stuff like, you know, if anything racist, that was not tolerated. And in part because FAMU was next door, and in part there was a prominent black population on campus, in part because, you know, at Florida State, we had three statues, integration statue, on campus that showed that there's black, prominent black life here. And so I'm going to keep saying that the university has to do a better job here, University of Florida, in recruiting black and brown students. It has to. It really has to, because it's the flagship. And if you're saying that you're the flagship of the state of Florida is 17% African American. On campus here is maybe, what, 4% or 5%? That's on campus. I'm not talking about UF online, because if you count those numbers, obviously it's different. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about on campus.
Walking around, going to class.
In the fall. Because I'm not even talking about Innovation Academy, which students don't come for the fall. I'm talking about walking around. It's only about 4% students on this campus. And that's, if you're the flat, that's not going to cut it. That's not going to cut it. And, you know, so, you know, and it just sets the atmosphere of students. Students who are racist, who have a racist mindset, they feel they could do whatever they want, because we're not in big fraternity and sorority houses. We don't have a prominent population here. You know, African American Studies program, we're big in the sense of the number of students we're teaching, but we're in a 3-room space. You know what I'm saying? We don't have a statue of Virgil Hawkins or any other prominent black leaders who've done great things here. You know, and so that all contributes to the ecosystem of the institution. And so once the institution understands that, that's when things will get better.
Right. That's really important, I think. Okay, so talking about some of these incidents, can you add some depth or insight of what's going on at UF now, like the politics? And I'm specifically referring to like the uprooting of the sign in front of the African American Studies and the Department Jewish Studies building right out here.
Yeah.
Then the racial slurs on the whiteboard of Anderson Hall, and then like the noose.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's been here. Like those, you know, people, unfortunately, I mean, you know, because a lot of people say, oh, it's because of Trump. No, it's not because of Trump. This has been happening. You know what I'm saying? And if the university doesn't get ahead of this type of stuff, it's going to keep happening. And my view on it is that, you know, you're always going to have a few idiots. You know, I think for the most part, the school is a good school, you know, but it's just, you know, it just is too reactive instead of being proactive. I asked a lot of our students, I would ask them, do you know who Virgil Hawkins is? And a lot of my Caucasian students who are seniors, they don't have any idea of who Virgil Hawkins is until they come here to African American Studies or maybe history, you know. And I'm like, that's not good.
It's not acceptable.
that is unacceptable. If you don't know how this institution became diverse, if you don't understand that this institution was an all-white male institution, if you don't understand those things, how can you really say that you care for diversity if you're not making sure that the students understand the history of how the school became diverse?
Right.
You know, and what that entails. What is diversity? You know what I'm saying? It's not just having a bunch of, you know, different faces. It's actually ensuring the well-being of those students and faculty that are here. And so, like I said, giving you the example of Dr. Austin, that is a prime example of why there needs to be more faculty here, you know, who are of color. A lot of complaints from my students, they feel that, you know, a lot of them want to transfer because they don't have a lot of mentorship or, you know, people that they can go to who look like them and be able to mentor them and, you know, give them, you know, good advice.
That's really important. So your answers are so awesome. I'm so excited. Okay, so April 2016, the Black Student Union awarded you Outstanding Professor of the Year. Mm-hmm. How did that make you feel? What, you know, what do you think are some of the things that you did to receive that? It's really impressive. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Especially being a first year faculty at that time. It was an overwhelming experience because, you know, we can have all these plaques and awards, but, you know, that was, you know, something where it was like, it's probably one of my finest moments I ever felt because, you know, I didn't feel like I was doing anything different. I was just being me as I've had been since I've got to this campus. Mm-hmm. And to be recognized with that award, you know, it really meant a lot. I didn't do anything different than what I've always done. Just be around, be there for the students. Yeah. If they need me, I'm here.
You're being proactive.
Right, being proactive and not reactive.
That's what you need.
Right.
Wow, okay. And then, so can you tell me about a little bit about the classes that you're teaching, like the On the Wire, and then the especially, well, not especially, but the Black masculinity.
Yeah.
And what your goals are with that?
So I'm teaching a course on, with the Black masculine course, what I saw here at the university was that, you know, there's not a lot of attention paid to as far as, because there's always, at this university, every class I've taught and the professors I've taught to, they always mention Black males in a certain way. Academically, like they know what it means to be a Black male, like, mm-hmm. oh, you must be from a desolate situation and this and that, and you know, there's always this negative slant, you know. And I felt it, like when I first came here, the assumption that I wasn't good enough to get a TA-ship, when a lot of my peers who came in with me, they getting funded by the department, not me. Why not? You know what I'm saying? So I created that course because I wanted to explore and have discourse on the many, the complications and the many facets of the Black male body and what that meant in history and what that means sociologically and what that means politically in America. You know, it's not just a simple, you know, of simple thing of labeling us of what America has been labeled us since we got here in 1619. So that's what I wanted to accomplish with that course. And I think it's done a good job. A lot of our students, when we leave there, you know, they have a, especially those who might study gender, who, you know, a lot of, women's studies majors, they take my course and they're like, wow, like, none of this stuff is being, you know, said in women's studies. And, you know, it's anytime there is anything about Black males, it's like from a different point of view, mm-hmm. from what they're used to. So having that depth and going a whole course, okay, this is what it means to be not only just Black male, but to perform masculinity in a Black body, because you could be a female, but perform masculinity within a Black body. That's powerful. The Wire course, what I wanted to accomplish with that was looking at the urban environment, urbanization of America within the context of Baltimore and the TV show The Wire, mm-hmm. Which focuses on that. So that's done a good job. Intro to African American Studies, just a basic foundation of African American Studies. And then the Mentoring At-Risk Youth. With that course, we actually go into the neighborhoods in the east side of Gainesville.
Okay.
And we actually mentor students. I make them do that for as part of their evaluation. And just learning what it means to be an at-risk youth and, you know, how to solutions for, you know, to move from at-risk to success. Mm-hmm. And now I'm developing a course on Black Wall Street. Mm-hmm. It's going to be called Black Wall Street, Discourse of Black Entrepreneurship and Black Enterprise.
Awesome.
So I'm going to be doing a lot with that course. So stay tuned.
Okay. I actually, I interviewed someone recently who is a Black male who worked on Wall Street and like went to Oxford and all this stuff. So mm-hmm. maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
Like,
yeah, connection.
Very
please.
Cool. Yeah, definitely. Okay. So, and to wrap anything up, do you have any final words?
I just want to say again, I think It's been a fabulous life, which I hope to continue to live, which I am going to continue to live, you know, until it's no more. But hopefully that's not for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, fabulous upbringing, fabulous education, good training, with the various jobs I worked, the various positions I've been in. And, you know, I have no regrets and no complaints about anything. And, you know, I'm just looking forward to the future.
And what would you say, what is your vision of UF in 10 or 20 years?
10 or 20 years, my vision is, if I had to give some specifics, I would say Black population is back up to 10% at least, as it was in 2008. I would say the African American Studies department is a department that by that time it has its own standalone building. Mm-hmm. As it, because Florida State, they actually, for their African American Studies program, they're building a 2-story, 5,600 square foot building for them. 2-story for their African American Studies.
5,600. Yes. Huge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also, lastly, as far as for the school, my vision would be that, you know, when the school talks about diversity, it really means diversity in all sectors. So not just African-American, but also Muslim, also LGBTQ, also, you know, because many of my African-American students are also part of the LGBTQ community as well, and are part of Muslim community. So, so you know, all of those different intersections, you know, my vision would be that there's not a lot of turnover in student affairs, which is going on currently right now, and that there's a cohesive working relationship with all organizations.
Well, thank you so much on behalf of the Proctor organization and myself. I appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.